Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and Merry Christmas to you on this fourth day of Christmas. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Carla Broussard is our guest, and we're doing drop call, open forum, all the calls that we didn't get to before during the year. Well, not all the calls, but a bunch of calls that we didn't get to before because the caller dropped, but we were like, well, we like that question. We'll answer it later. And so today is the day. Today is later. Today is the day we get to do that. Carlo, thanks for coming back.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Cy. Merry Christmas to you, buddy.
Merry Christmas. Thank you very, very much. Sarah, who's just really good at running the board, is running the board today. But Chris Check brought some King Charles Spaniels, or at least one King Charles Spaniel, into the building. You ran out of here so fast at the break to see that King Charles Spaniel.
They call it puppy therapy.
Is that where you went to see the dog?
I did.
Yeah. Was it one dog or did he bring multiple dogs?
He brought two dogs.
Two King Charles Spaniels.
I didn't even know what was in customer service. I just felt it.
There's something cute in the building. I got to move. Yeah. I don't even know if you turned the microphones off. You just out of here to see the King Charles Spaniels. Well, is that what they're doing in customer service right now? They're just visiting with King Charles Spaniels?
Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's what we do here at Catholic Answers.
Yeah.
We enjoy all the creaturely goods of God's created order.
Right. And there's very few creatures sweeter than a King Charles Spaniel puppy. So, I'm glad you came back
for
this hour.
Oh, never mind.
There are no what? Oh, no, don't. I know what you're going to say. No, you're not. Merry Christmas, Carlo.
We're going to get some evil emails, man.
Carlo's message is repent and believe the bad news. No, we don't need you delivering bad news today, Carlo.
All right.
Look at those stockings back there.
Yeah, they look good, man. I like the decoration. We got the festive lights in the hallways here at Catholic Answers, Christmas trees in every corner.
We got two Charlie Brown Christmas trees right behind us, and then a real Christmas tree over here.
It's pretty cool, man.
Feels very, very Christmassy, and there's puppies in the building. And a lot of things with sugar in them have been in this building this week. It doesn't matter to Carlo. He doesn't care. Carlo's like, is it made out of meat? Okay, then I'm not eating it. Would they make that cookie out? Is it a meat cookie? Then I'm not eating it. You know what? Enjoy your low-carb lifestyle, Carlo. You enjoy that.
I do. Yeah, I do. But speaking of sweet things,
yes.
We got you, Cy.
Oh. Just give me a minute to pull myself. Oh, man. Don't get me going. Don't get the waterworks going, Carlo.
Just by your presence, you create a festive atmosphere.
Thank you,
man.
Carlo. Thank you very, very much. It does feel festive. I like this feeling. Yeah, I know you do. You're very nice, Carlo. All right, let's go to Canada for a question.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Let's do it.
Montreal.
Montreal.
Montreal. That was us doing some Canadian French. I hope you enjoyed that, Canada. That's our special Christmas gift to you.
Matt Nelson, don't call me, buddy.
All right, Guillaume in Montreal, Canada. Is that French for William? Guillaume?
I don't know
either. I hope it is. His name is William, and he was listening on the Catholic Answers website, and he said, if we are surrounded by a crowd of witnesses, is it reasonable to believe that our deceased loved ones and the saints are aware of what we are doing and thinking, even if we cannot experience their presence? Is it reasonable to believe that my deceased loved ones are in communion with me momentarily through the body of Christ when receiving communion?
With regard to the second question, being in communion with us, the answer is yes. And that's in virtue of them being members of the mystical body of Christ. They're in communion with us via grace. With regard to the first question, are they aware of what we're doing right now, currently, and then secondly, thinking? Well, with regard to what we're doing, St. Thomas addresses this in the Prima Pars, the first part of his Summa Theologiae, question 89. He has several different articles where he's going through the knowledge that a separated soul separated from its body, would have and be able to have, and being aware of things being done here on earth. And ultimately, he answers this question in the affirmative that they would be aware of what we're doing here on earth, but it's important to nuance the way in which they would know. So if we're talking about the separated soul's natural knowledge, like would a soul in heaven know what I'm doing here on earth by way of its natural powers or natural way of knowing things? The answer would be no, because we as rational animals our proper mode of knowing things, for my intellect to come to understand things, is to take in information from the senses. So we use, the body is playing a role in the human mode of knowing things. And even once we take in the information from our sensory apparatus, right, when we're sensing things, for the intellect to do its work, it's actually using what philosophers call phantasms, right? These images that we're conjuring up, a triangle. I'm thinking of a triangle. I'm imagining a triangle, right? I'm thinking of psi. I'm imagining psi. And the intellect goes to work on that image, right? What is called a phantasm, and begins to understand what that thing is and all that good stuff. And that's the proper mode of understanding. That's the natural way of coming to know things and be aware of what's going on outside of us. So when the soul separates from the body, guess what? Soul no longer has the body to do its natural operation of knowing things as it's happening right here and right now. And so the soul separated from the body wouldn't be able to do that in a natural way. So the question becomes, well, how could the soul know what's going on right here and right now without the body? And Aquinas answers that the soul would know in virtue of seeing the divine essence in the beatific vision of seeing God. In virtue of seeing God, the soul would have that knowledge in God and seeing God of what's going on in our lives here, right here, right here and right now. So that's one way. That's Aquinas' position in virtue of the beatific vision. Yes, they know what's going on here right now. But there's another way. One could postulate the idea that maybe God would infuse within the intellect of the soul the knowledge that is needed. And there's a nuanced distinction between these two modes of knowing, these ways of knowing. But this other way is like God just downloading, so to speak, this knowledge into the intellect of what's going on here on earth. Either way you go, it's going to be a supernatural knowledge, a knowledge above the nature, the natural way, right? So no, if natural, yes, if supernatural.
Isn't that something?
To put it simply, yeah.
This is a little bit off of William's question. And William, I hope that answer helped you. I found that answer very, very helpful. But what about our memories? Do we have access to our memories?
Absolutely. St. Thomas, in question 89, talks about the knowledge the separated soul would have of those things already known, right?
Okay.
And memories that are sort of sealed, right, in the intellectual memory. The sense images, that's a different question, but you also have conceptual memories, right, and things that we know and we come to know that can be going beyond the senses, right, breaking the boundaries of the senses and conceptual knowledge. Aquinas does affirm, and I think he's right on this, that we will have that knowledge. Notice this question was about knowing what's going on here and now.
Right.
No, it's sort of a current and progressive coming to know.
Yeah.
And so your question is, what has already been known?
Yeah, right.
And Aquinas affirms, yes, the separated soul will have that knowledge.
How interesting.
Concerning this knowledge of right here and right now and ongoing, not naturally, but in a supernatural way. So God's going to have to be doing something on the intellect, with the intellect, in order for us to know what's going on here and now.
I can't stop asking you questions about this. I'm so interested in this.
It's going to be similar to the angels, of how the angels know what is going on. The angels don't, in their proper mode of knowing, they don't know in and through the body.
No, because they have no body.
They have no body. So the knowledge that they have is by way of kind of infuse, like in philosophy we call it species or forms, right? But God is infusing this stuff in the angel's intellect. But that's natural to the angel.
Yeah.
For the soul to have that kind of knowledge.
Yeah.
That's a supernatural kind of knowledge. That's over and above the soul's natural way of knowing things.
At the risk of being shallow, I like my five senses. And when the body is resurrected, will I have the five senses, or do we
absolutely
not know?
You get them back? So the the soul then with the resurrected body. Notice Aquinas is addressing the question of the knowledge that a separated soul has.
Right.
currently in the beatific vision. But when with the bodily resurrection, when the soul is reunited back to its body, well, then the soul then begins to know, like I, Carlo, begin to know now according to the natural mode of human knowing through the senses. So in the resurrected body side, you'll have your resurrected body. I have mine. We'll be giving each other high fives. I'll be seeing you. You'll be seeing me. Whether we're munching on sweet things or not, that's a different question.
Yeah, right. Wait, what's in heaven and available to our senses? That's a different question. Right. I don't really care about that.
But we'll be knowing currently what's going on in the natural mode of human understanding.
Right.
With taking in the data through
without
our
losing
senses.
The supernatural in any way.
That's right, because the beatific vision will remain. The intellect will be knowing God's essence in that immediate, direct way without any sort of concepts. We'll be knowing, we'll be having that quote unquote heaven experience of the beatific vision, even while we're still doing the natural way of knowing things. Yeah. And then, of course, we'll have new knowledge that's given to us by way of the completeness of the divine order of providence and history and how all things culminated with the second coming of Christ and all that fun stuff. Heaven is definitely a destiny worth living for.
I know. It sounds, when you start thinking about it, like, and, because you think of all the things that your senses will perceive when you, right, but you will physically see Jesus and Mary and
absolutely.
Peter and John.
And that would be a source of great joy.
Yeah. Well, I would like to see, after all this, frankly,
too,
I'm going to be honest with you, Carlo, I would like to see Jesus face to face. Like, I don't want to go through all this and not see him face to face.
And think about this, too. I was talking to a little bit about this with Adam Minahan and David Niles on the Catholic Man Show when I was in Tulsa a few weeks ago. In the bodily resurrection, the sensory experience will be, as I like to say, humming, baby. It's going to be humming, right? It's going to be firing on all cylinders, right? So the sensory experience of the bodily resurrection is going to be heightened in a way that we cannot even imagine, because it's going to be so completed and perfected in that glorified state where it's taking on the perfection of the soul that the soul has in the beatific vision. And so there's going to be this influx and overflow of great joy and satisfaction and pleasurable delight within the body and the senses being heightened to perfection. I mean, listen, I got.
But none of it is going to overwhelm you, and you'll be at perfect peace because of the beatific vision. Everything will stay in perfect proportion.
Yep.
Because that's the big problem here. Like, if I have an overwhelming sensory experience, it's likely to become unbalanced.
That's right. I'm not in this state, on this side of the veil, I'm not going to be able to have control over that, right?
And but so, there, because of the beatific
perfect
vision.
Perfect control.
Yeah. I kind of want to go to heaven
and
now.
And given that we're in the Christmas season here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why our Lord, the Christ child in the manger, pointing us to this destiny. He was born for this sake, for us to experience this heavenly realm.
Thank you, Jesus. Really, you can't just stop saying thank you. You just
absolutely.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more questions on this fourth day of Christmas for Carlo Broussard on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, this Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Let me give you the clue again, how to get the prize. They might all be gotten by now. I don't know. But maybe there's still available 5 free books each day during the 12 days of Christmas at shop.catholic.com. The way you get them is you follow the clue that I'm about to give you. Look for something that matches that clue. And then when you find it, see if it if there's still a prize available there. Five prizes available in all. And the clue for today, because it's the fourth day of Christmas, hark the herald with glory words. Joyful find four calling birds. Four calling birds, the clue for day four over at shop.catholic.com.
Heaven will be a joyful find.
Yes, heaven will be. I thought that was going to be a poem. I was waiting for the second line.
Dude, I'm not that savvy.
I thought this was going to be a couplet.
I am not that savvy, man.
Sorry to disappoint. Heaven will be a joyful find, not like the earth's daily grind.
Whoa!
That's right. I just dropped that on you, Carlo.
But from the Christian perspective, the daily grind is infused with great joy. Because we do it out of love for God.
All right.
We rejoice in our sufferings, as St. Paul says in Colossians 1:24. Boom!
he dropped it right back on me.
Joy in the daily grind.
Yeah, dropped some St. Paul on me out of the blue. I didn't expect that. I didn't see that coming.
But I will say, that was pretty good shooting from the hip there, buddy.
Shooting from the hip because I'm on a trip. That one didn't go as well. Okay. All right. It's time to go on to the questions. Christian in San Antonio, Texas. Listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. He says, my brother argues that Jesus was supposed to be the last high priest. Why do Catholics believe that there could be more priests after Jesus?
Okay, so this is how I would begin to address this issue. Jesus is the high priest. That is true. And we do not believe that there are priests apart from Jesus, or priests such that they would somehow undermine or usurp the high priestly ministry of Jesus. So even though we affirm that Jesus is the high priest, one question to pose to Christian here would be, does his priesthood exclude anyone from being a priest in any sense? And of course, he's going to have to answer no. Because St. Peter teaches in 1 Peter 2, 5 and 9 that Christian believers are a holy priesthood, a royal priesthood, right? A holy nation. And of course, Peter is alluding to Exodus 19, 6, where Israel is referred to as a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. So just because Jesus is the high priest, it does not follow from that that there are no priests in any sense. Because all believers as Christians are priests in and through Jesus Christ, the one true high priest. Following me so far?
Gotcha.
Okay. The next question is, okay, well, if Jesus' high priesthood does not necessarily exclude priests in any sense, well, then at least it's possible that there might be a group of Christian believers who are priests in a ministerial sense, and that still not usurp the unique priesthood of Jesus Christ, because that ministerial priesthood would be participating in the unique priesthood of Jesus Christ. So the question becomes, does Jesus make any believers ministerial priests, like Aaron and his sons were ministerial priests, even though all the Israelites were priests in some sense?
Right.
Aaron and his sons were a distinct class of priests. So the question is, did Jesus set it up that way for the new Israel of God? St. Paul calls the church the Israel of God in Galatians 6:16. In the old Israel, you had universal priesthood of all Israelites, but yet a distinct class of ministerial priests with Aaron and his sons. Paul calls us the Israel of God. We're told by Peter that all believers are the universal priesthood. We're all priests. But then, is there a ministerial priestly class like Aaron and his sons in the New Testament? And I answer yes, and the church answers yes. Of course, it's me, like, you know, following the church here.
Right.
The church answers yes. And the evidence, there's a few lines of evidence that we could propose here. And I do so in my article, Did Jesus Make the Apostles Priests at the Last Supper? That would be one line of reasoning, so our listeners can check that out. At the Last Supper, Jesus tells the apostles, do this in remembrance of me, right? Now, what's interesting there, Si, is that the Greek word for do this, or the Greek verb for do this, poieo, has sacrificial overtones. That's the Greek word used in the Septuagint, Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures, in Exodus 29:38, Leviticus 9:7, and Psalm 66:15, with regard to offering sacrifice. Do this, poieo, has sacrificial overtones. It means to, it can be used in the sense of offering sacrifice. Even the Greek word for remembrance, anamnesis, has sacrificial overtones. For example, in the Septuagint of Numbers, in Numbers chapter 10, verse 10 of the Septuagint, sacrifices of peace offerings are said to serve you for remembrance, anamnesis, before your God. So you have these two Greek words, poieo, anamnesis, both of which in the Greek version of the Old Testament have strong sacrificial overtones. And Jesus is applying those two words to the apostles at the Last Supper. Do this in remembrance of me. In other words, offer this, right, as an offering to God, as a remembrance to God. Now, if Jesus is commanding the apostles to offer this sacrifice, well, then that implies that he intends them to be priests. Why? Because it is the job of a priest to offer sacrifice. Now, what's interesting here is that this is a command given only to the apostles within a context where only the apostles are present. It is true that we as Christian believers, as priests, offer sacrifices, but we're told to offer spiritual sacrifices. That's what Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. And Paul tells us in Romans 12, 1, offer our bodies as a living sacrifice. But here we have Jesus telling the apostles to offer a unique kind of sacrifice, very similar to how Aaron and his sons were to offer sacrifices in a way that the other Israelites could not offer sacrifice. And so from this truth of Christ instructing the apostles to offer the Last Supper as a sacrifice in a very unique way, the church has concluded from that biblical data that Christ is instituting the apostles as his ministerial priests, as priests to function in order to serve the universal priesthood in a way that participates in Jesus' high priestly ministry, very much like Aaron and his sons ministered to the Israelites as ministerial priests. So that's one line of evidence, and then we could look at others. Jesus giving the apostles the authority to forgive sins. Paul recognizes his ministry as a priestly ministry in Romans 15, 15 through 6. But that I think that suffices for now to focus on the Last Supper.
Christian, it's a great question your brother has. I hope that's helpful in answering him. You can have him call us if he's got follow-up questions, or you're always welcome to call. We look forward to that. I'm going to go on to an anonymous caller. An anonymous caller was on the line but dropped at a certain point. But here's the question. What would it take for you to have a disbelief in a deity? So does that mean, like, basically stop believing in God?
Right, yeah. Right. Is there any sort of way in virtue of which we could show that God does not exist? Now, there are some philosophers who will say no for very nuanced reasons, but I think ultimately there are a couple of ways that you could show that we should not believe in God as we understand him to be classically defined. So number one, we could show that our concept of God contradicts some known fact. And the classic example of that is the problem of evil, right? So if God is all good, well, then no evil would exist. Evil does exist. Therefore, God is not all good. And if he's not all good, well, then he's not God as we understand him in the classical way. So if our concept of God contradicts some known fact, well, then that would provide us reason to no longer believe in God as classically defined. Now, I don't think that argument works, because I don't think those, you know, especially the first premise is true. There are ways to argue against that first premise, that you can have and affirm an all good God and the reality of evil.
Yeah.
Those two truths are indeed compatible with one another. We don't have time to justify that claim, but there is
if there was any fact in the universe that you could establish as a fact and say that if this fact is true, there can't be a God like you think of a God,
right,
then we would have to give up our belief in God.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a legitimate path to take. And then secondly, we could show, or one could attempt to show, that our concept of God entails an intrinsic contradiction.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is actually something that I'm doing for my dissertation, for my PhD in philosophy. So for example, some will say God's divine immutability, like God cannot change, and his freedom to have created otherwise. So some will say those two ideas are intrinsically incompatible with one another. But for us, in understanding God as classically defined, you got to have both. You can't give up one or the other. If God's not immutable, like if God can change, well, then he ain't God, right, as we classically understand him to be.
Right.
And if he's not free to have created otherwise, well, then he wouldn't be God either, because his very being would be dependent upon creatures, right? In order to be him, he's got to have creatures. Well, that would make him dependent. Well, if he's dependent on creatures, well,
that's not what we think of as God.
Absolutely.
Right.
So if you can show that there are two aspects of our concept of God that are intrinsically incompatible, that are contradictory of one another— if that would be true, well, then we would have to give up on that concept of God. And that would be another path somebody could take. Now, as I point out, as I'm arguing for in my dissertation, both of these are compatible. God is immutable, and he's free to have created otherwise.
So you can't find a fact in the universe that contradicts our belief in God.
And I would argue you cannot.
And you can't find a logical inconsistency in belief in God.
I would argue you cannot.
So we can believe in God.
Absolutely.
Okay. But if you could do those things. All right, right back.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Carla Broussard is our guest. Merry Christmas. It's the fourth day of Christmas. That anonymous question asking what, which is a question we often get from, we don't know if this person is atheist or not, but it could be just a person who wants to know, how do you answer this kind of question? But one thing that I do want to encourage in the coming year, in the year 2023, is more atheists to call, because we really do enjoy those conversations. Call when Carla's on. I know you enjoy those conversations, sure, with atheists. And I feel like... I don't know what we've done, but we're getting fewer calls from atheists. And I don't know if how we've driven away the atheists. You know, every now and then we do, but not as much as we used to. And it could be a good sign, like maybe atheism is waning. And I would take that as a good sign if more people were believing in God. But I doubt that that's the case. So I do want to – we're not taking calls today. So, oh, easy for me to say today. But call anytime. We do like talking with you. And we welcome those questions. This next one, what we're doing today is we're taking calls that we couldn't take because the person dropped. It's a drop call, open forum. But we like their questions, so we wanted to take them. David in Pennsylvania was watching on YouTube, and he called up and said, why is there a waiting period for the church to baptize candidates? And I know that this bugs some people. Yeah. And it bugs some people because they're like, you know, Philip, he baptized the Ethiopian, or, you know, right. Why don't we just do it the way Philip did it?
Yeah, it's not an absolute necessity, but we're dealing with ordinary circumstances, right? And then asking what or sort of the what's the rationale behind or the reasons for this waiting period. So with regard to basically, I think we can say that we're following the church is following the early church practice of preparation for baptism, instruction in the mysteries of faith and the mysteries of the sacraments. Currently, this is known as RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults. But why wait? Well, one possible answer is to make sure that the person preparing for baptism really knows what he or she is getting into as a Christian.
Yeah.
So you really want to know what you're assenting to. And secondly, to really get an understanding of what – so what the first reason is knowing what the Christian life entails. Like this is how you need to be living as a Christian. And that's going to require a lot of change in some cases, right? But also to know the mysteries of faith that you are assenting to intellectually, to say, I believe these things revealed by God as a Christian. And so that's part of the preparation as well. So – in order to attain the proper head knowledge for an informed assent by the mind to believe these things, but also a proper formation of the heart knowledge to know the Christian lived experience of what you're jumping into and what you're going to have to take on as a Christian just in your whole lifestyle, and which, as I mentioned, requires that some things might have to change given your prior lifestyle and prior lifestyle choices. And so I think for those two reasons, that provides a rationale or a basis for why in ordinary circumstances a person needs to go through that preparation, because not everybody comes to the church in the way that, say, Scott Hahn came to the Catholic Church, you know, whenever right. he converted and, you know, reading all of these books, and he was more formed than most people in the Catholic Church, right?
Right, yeah.
Now, granted, he didn't have to get baptized in order to become Catholic, but in order to be confirmed and in full communion, you know, in that sort of circumstance, a priest might make an exception and say, yeah, you know, if somebody comes and not a non-baptized person did all of this studying and like has been sort of swimming in the Christian waters of the Christian community for a long time as a non-baptized person, well, then a priest might make that exception and say, hey, I'll baptize you this weekend, right?
I see, yeah.
But not everybody saying, I want to be Catholic, I want to be baptized, is in that circumstance, is in that state, right? They may come to the church and say, yeah, I really want to be baptized, but not have this sort of deeper understanding of what the Christian life and Christian belief is all about. And so there's going to be a need of that time of preparation, of course, again, in ordinary circumstances. Now, this, I think, Cy, the implied question here is, well, what happens if somebody doesn't make it to baptism? And I think that's what's really driving the question.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Like, why are you going to wait so long if baptism is so important and necessary? What happens if they don't get it? Are they not going to be saved or something?
Right.
Well, if we're talking about a catechumen, and that's the word to describe a person who is explicitly seeking to be baptized, right? The Council of Trent teaches that justification from original sin is not possible without the washing unto regeneration, baptism, or the desire for the same. So this is, in our tradition, known as an explicit desire for baptism. That suffices to receive the graces of baptism and thus be saved. So if a person's getting ready for baptism in RCIA and they happen, unfortunately, to die before baptism, that explicit desire is sufficient in order to receive the graces of baptism. Catechism affirms this in paragraph 1259. Now, here's the next question. Well, what about somebody who's not a catechumen, somebody who's not explicitly desiring or seeking baptism, but nevertheless has invincible ignorance? They're not responsible for their ignorance. Well, we could take the position of Aquinas. Here's what Aquinas says in his work called On Truth, De Veritate, question 14, article 11. In his response to the first objection, he says, God would either reveal to him through internal inspiration, would have to be believed, mm-hmm. or would send some preacher of the faith to him as he sent Peter to Cornelius. That's what Aquinas says. So either God's going to infuse that knowledge, here's what you got to believe, yes or no, or send a preacher to preach to the person, here's what you got to believe, do you respond yes or no? Or we could take the church's current position, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 1260, every man who is ignorant of the gospel of Christ and of his church, but seeks the truth and does the will of God in accordance with his understanding of it, can be saved. It may be supposed that such person would have desired baptism explicitly if they had known its necessity. This is commonly referred to as an implicit desire for baptism versus the explicit desire of the catechumen. So is it possible for a non-catechumen to be saved without baptism? The bottom line answer is yes, it's possible. But by whatever grace he is saved by, that's coming from Jesus, baby.
That is coming from Jesus.
Because he is the way, baby. The truth, and the life. You like that, baby?
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Right. I love that answer. And thanks very much to David in Pennsylvania for the question. I hope that was helpful to you, David. Not giving out the number today because all the questions are questions that already came to us by the phone, but the caller dropped. It's called Drop Call Open Forum. Lots and lots of calls and questions for Carlo this hour. And Carlo, I'm going to give you one from Christine in Charleston, South Carolina. She was listening on 7:30 a.m., and she called to ask this. We understand that before there was confession, people went to heaven. What changed that now we have to go to confession to get to heaven, but people in the Old Testament did not?
Yeah, good question. So first of all, we want to affirm the truth that Christine is stating here. It is true that people in the Old Testament, before confession, before the revelation of the sacrament of confession, died in friendship with God, and they went to heaven upon Jesus' ascension. So they went to heaven without a confession. That's true. We believe that. Now, what is assumed in the second part of Christine's question is false, namely that confession is absolutely necessary to go to heaven.
Okay.
And so that is something we do not claim. We do say that confession is necessary for our salvation, and I'm talking about going to confession to be remitted of the guilt of mortal sin. It is necessary for confession for salvation to be in friendship with Jesus in ordinary circumstances, okay? So ordinary circumstances would be a circumstance beyond, for example, imminent death, right, where you don't have access to a priest, or special revelation that I've been actually forgiven of the guilt of my mortal sin through perfect charity. Yeah. I mean, that's possible, and that brings up this point that as Catholics, we believe, we profess, we teach that perfect contrition is what I meant to say, which involves perfect charity. Perfect contrition would be sufficient for the remission of the guilt of mortal sin. But that perfect contrition involves the intention to receive the sacrament of confession for those who know about it. So is it possible to have the guilt of mortal sin taken away through perfect contrition without the sacrament of confession? Yes, it is possible. But the only way I'm going to know that is if God gives me a special revelation of that, right? So that special revelation, that would be an extraordinary circumstance where confession is not necessary for salvation or an imminent death. I don't have access to a priest. So if I have perfect contrition at that moment of death, that would suffice to remit the guilt of mortal sin and thus be saved. And so I can be saved without the sacrament of confession. But in ordinary circumstances, and I'm guilty of mortal sin, I need the sacrament of reconciliation in order to be reestablished, spiritually resurrected, to be reestablished in friendship with Jesus Christ and thus being in a saving state, right? Thus, if I die in that friendship, I would be saved, finally speaking. So it's important that we expose this flawed assumption that confession is absolutely necessary. In other words, in all circumstances, without confession, you cannot go to heaven. That is not what we believe.
Okay.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean in ordinary circumstances, confession is not the path you need to take in order to have the guilt of mortal sin taken off of your soul so that you can go to heaven.
Got
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. Okay. I think that makes very good sense. We got to take a break, Christine, but thanks very much for that question from Charleston, South Carolina. We'll take a very quick break and be right back with more Drop Calls Open Forum with Carlo Broussard.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Wherever you are in the world, you can access the EWTN Global Catholic Network. It's everywhere. You can get EWTN's great Catholic programming on your car radio, at home on your TV, computer, or smart speaker. With EWTN's app, you can take EWTN everywhere, on your phone or mobile device. If you want your news in print, turn to EWTN's paper of record, the National Catholic Register. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Merry Christmas to you. It's the fourth day of the 12 days of Christmas, and Carlo Broussard is here with us, and this is a good Carlo question coming up, because it's a complicated one, but one I think you can put into terms that we can understand, and I don't want to avoid complicated questions, because it's a good one. Adam in Ohio asked. Adam was watching on YouTube. He called up to ask this. What is the difference between the Thomistic view of predestination and the Calvinistic view? That's the first question.
Yeah.
And then he says, do you hold a Thomistic view or Molinistic view of free will?
Yeah.
Now, these are hard questions. Predestination and free will are hard questions.
Yeah, but and it also assumes a lot of background knowledge about these different positions and stuff.
Right.
So suffice to say, we can't get into all the details here, but I thought it would be a good question to address to try to give somewhat of a summarized conceptual framework of the two. I can only make assertions here without any sort of justification for and against either of the views. So let's take the first question concerning predestination. Now, there's two senses of this. A strict sense, which would refer to those human beings who will be finally saved. At the end of time, all those people with Jesus on the new heaven and the new earth, right? Experiencing beatific vision. The wide sense of predestination can refer to God's preordained plan of providence, right? But with regard to the strict sense concerning the difference between the Thomistic and the Calvinistic view, you have the same end result. That's basically when this question comes up, we're talking about that strict sense of predestination. Who's going to be finally be saved? We both agree with the end result. A numbered group that will finally make it, right? Where we differ is the mode of free will or the preservation of human free will in attaining that end result of being finally saved. So the Thomistic view, following St. Thomas Aquinas and his thought, has a nuanced view of God causing our free choices, and that's something else we're going to agree with our Calvinist friends, God causes our free choices. But from the Thomist view, God causes our free choices in a way that actually preserves the mode of human freedom. Unlike, for example, if I cause you to do something, like I am physically coercing you to get out of this room.
Okay.
That would be a circumstance where I'm actually violating your mode of human freedom.
Right.
The end result, you getting out of the room, in this case, would not be a result of your free will. It's going to be all me, right?
Gotcha.
So my causation of you is not preserving your freedom. It's violating your freedom.
Okay.
The Thomist view has a nuanced way of showing how when God causes me to do something, to bring about some result through the use of my free choice, that my free choice is still free. That freedom is preserved. Now, again, that's a claim that needs justification. I can't do that here. On the other hand, opposing that view, the Calvinistic view is going to agree with the Thomist that God causes our free choices, but it's just that that causation does not preserve the mode of freedom. That the end result is going to be entirely God, that the free will in no way is free in God causing the will to do some action, right? For me to make some choice.
Got it.
So the key difference there is going to be one view preserves a mode of human freedom, the other view violates it or does not. That's going to be the difference between the Thomistic view and the Calvinistic view. Now, concerning the question of Thomas or Molinist view of free will, again, the Thomas view says God causes our free choices, but he causes us in a way that we can act in a way that's in accord with our mode of freedom. There's a preservation of that mode of freedom. Now, the Molinist view, this is coming from Luis Molina, a 16th century Spanish Jesuit priest. He says, or as I understand him in his teaching and those who follow him, God does not cause our free will or our free choices, to be more precise. Freedom is sort of a no-fly zone for God, right? God orders our choices according to his plan, right? So he takes into consideration our free choices within his providential plan based upon his perfect knowledge of those choices and things that my choices or possible choices could bring about. But notice that on this view, the Molinist view, free choices are no fly zone for God's causation. God's not causing, bringing into actuality, right? Making it to be that I'm freely choosing something. So that's the Molinist view. Whereas the Thomas view is going to say, no, God is causing our free choices, bringing it into actuality, making it be. But because he's God, his causation's very different than when I cause you to do something.
Right.
So
he has the power.
His causation's not going to violate my freedom. It's actually going to make my freedom be, my free choice be. Now, to the question, which view do I adopt? I personally, my opinion, and the church has not given any sort of definitive answer to this question of which view is correct, right? I personally hold to the Thomas view, and for two reasons, one positive, one negative. So if we take the positive reason, think about this. God is the cause of all being and even every mode of being, like however being is going to be shaped or formed, right? If you think of it like that. My free choice as being, it's an actuality. It's falling under the umbrella of reality and being. Yeah. And it's of a particular mode of being. We call it contingency in philosophy, but it's like a particular way of existing, a particular mode of being. And so therefore it would follow God is the cause of my free choice. Okay. Now the negative reason is this. If we say God doesn't cause my free choice, well then there's some aspect of being that escapes God's causality.
Yeah.
But I thought God was the source of all being.
Yeah.
Which we affirm he is as God.
Right.
So if we deny that God actually causes my free choices, then I'm saying there's something in being that's not due to God making it be.
Yeah.
And that's robbing God of being the source of all being. And so that conflicts with the classical understanding of God being the source of all being. So for both the positive reason and the negative reason, I favor the Thomas view. But again, that's my personal preference, which I do have an opinion, and I think the arguments are persuasive as it being the right view. But again, I could not bind somebody's conscience to believe it as a good Catholic, because the church has never given us a definitive answer on this question.
But it does strike me that both of those Catholic answers, the Molinist view or the Thomistic view, leave me with a free choice.
Yes.
Whatever happens, my free choice, I am free to choose.
That is correct. Absolutely.
Not being compelled in any way.
That would be an agreement or a similarity between the two views.
Right.
Yeah. The difference being on whether God causes that free choice or not.
Uh-huh. All right, Adam, I do appreciate it. I know that's a tough one, but I appreciate that you asked it, and I hope that the answer was helpful to you. This one comes from Andrew in Michigan, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Andrew wanted to know, how should I talk to a non-Catholic who tries to receive the Eucharist?
Well, I think we could start by explaining what Holy Communion entails. So first of all, it's going to entail belief that the Eucharist is the real body and blood of Jesus. So if my friend doesn't believe that, well, then they shouldn't be receiving. Otherwise, they would be lying, right? Going up to do this thing where visibly testifies, I believe that this is Jesus, when in reality you don't. But let's say my friend does believe. Like, yeah, I believe Jesus is really there. I'm just not going to be a Catholic, right? So what do we say in response? Well, again, explain what Holy Communion entails. Excuse me. Not only does it involve belief that Jesus is really there, but it also visibly testifies to union with the church in everything that the church teaches for us to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So consider this quote from Justin Martyr in the 2nd century, AD 150, in his first Apology, chapter 66. He's talking about the Eucharist, and he says this: "As this food is called among us Eucharistia, the Eucharist, of which no one is allowed to partake, but the man who believes that the things we teach are true and who has been washed with the washing," that is, baptism. So as Justin Martyr articulates there, in order to receive the Eucharist and Holy Communion, you need to be believing everything that we believe. Why? Because that act of receiving Holy Communion in ordinary circumstances is visibly testifying that I am in communion with the church itself and everything that she proposes for us to believe. So if the individual, so we could ask our friend, do you believe everything that the church believes? And if the answer is no, well, then you ought not to receive at least those things that the church proposes for belief in an infallible way, right? That we need to assent to either with divine and Catholic faith, dogma stuff, or definitive assent, which is all that stuff related to dogma, right?
Right.
Infallible teaching. If the answer is no, well, then we ought not to receive. Why? Because we would be signifying in our bodily gesture, the bodily act of receiving Holy Communion, I believe everything that the Catholic Church proposes to be believed. But in reality, subjectively, I would not be consistent with what that action entails. So there would be a falsification of what the action means, right? It would be a lie. I'd be lying with my body. Pope St. John Paul II used this way of thinking with regard to the sexual act and the conjugal act. That action has a sort of built-in meaning to it of being ordered to procreation and unitive love. And whenever somebody's going to engage in that activity, they need to make sure that they are consistent, like they're intending what that activity involves. Otherwise, you're going to be acting against the meaning. Right,
right.
Similarly here, the act of receiving Holy Communion, there's a built-in meaning in that. Like, I'm in communion with the church as a whole, and I believe everything that the church proposes to be believed. And so if that's not the case, I would be acting against that meaning. I would be in conflict with that meaning and thus be lying with that act and lying with my body. Again, in ordinary circumstances, that would be the case.
Thank you very much for that question. I appreciate it. I hope that was helpful to you. I know that a lot of times people are not convinced. I'm always surprised at what a tough one this one is for some people.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't know if it just seems like if I'm not a member of something in most areas of the world, like if I don't work here, then I don't get to come to the Christmas party, if I'm not a member of the LA Chargers, I don't get to put on the uniform. We get that, but for some reason people are deeply offended that the Catholic Church says, and I know my analogies are kind of weak, but they're deeply offended that the Catholic says this is for the Catholic person who's in full communion with the church. I don't myself understand why that's so offensive to people, but people do are deeply offended.
And
by
then
it.
A possible question would be, well, why do you believe it's really Jesus? What's the power in virtue of which that bread is changed into Jesus? If you believe it's the priest who has the power, well, if you believe the priest has the power to change the bread into Jesus Christ, well, why don't you? And the only reason why you should believe that is because the church has taught us so. So why don't you believe everything else that the church teaches, right? So why are you going to pick and choose only that and not these other things? Or if you think, well, I have the power because of my belief, the bread changes into Jesus Christ, well, then that's something essentially different than what we're professing as Catholics. And so therefore you have another conflict with the act and what that entails and what's in your heart.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Carlo. Thanks very much. You should definitely check out Carlo's new podcast, Sunday Catholic Word. It's not too late. Just get started because he's going to go through the full 3-year cycle. As a matter of fact, you can start at any time because basically what it does is Carlo takes a look at the Sunday readings on Friday, each Friday, from the perspective of a Catholic apologist. How does he, as a Catholic apologist, think about the Bible readings for this Sunday in a way that helps explain and defend the Catholic faith. So build up your apologetics chops, but also prepare for Sunday Mass each Friday with Sunday Catholic Word. SundayCatholicWord.com or Mr. Catholic Podcast.
Mr. Sunday Podcast.
Oh, sorry. Dang it. MrSundayPodcast.com. Thanks, Carlo.
Thank you, Si. It was fun, Matt.
That does it for us. Tomorrow, one of the two big year-end shows. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.